The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Hong Zhe's Guidepost of Silent Illumination. Silent and serene, forgetting words, bright clarity appears before you. When you reflect it, you become vast. Where you embody it, you're spiritually uplifted. Spiritually solitary and shining, inner illumination restores wonder. Dew in the moonlight, a river of stars, snow-covered pines, clouds enveloping the peaks. In darkness, it is most bright, while hidden, all the more manifest. So many of you are familiar with Master Hong Zhe. You've all probably by this point encountered him, even if unaware. He was a very important Chan master, 12th century, about 100 years before Dogen. He entered the monastery when he was 11. So imagine being 11. It was a different time. He was ordained at 14. And then in his early 20s, he met his teacher in the Soto tradition, and went on to train and succeed and become a teacher in his own right. He became the abbot of Tiantong Monastery, which is where Dogen went when he went to China. Remember that Dogen went looking, as he said, for a true teacher. He traveled and went to different monasteries, was not, did not find what he was looking for. And evidently was preparing to leave and go back to Japan. And then he heard about this new abbot at Tiantong Monastery, who was Hong Zhe. No, not Hong Zhe, but rather several generations successive. And so he went there, and that's where he met Juching and came to full enlightenment and then came back to Japan. And Hong Zhe is known as he's one of the great poets of the Zen tradition. He compiled the Book of Serenity, so that koan collection. He compiled the koans and then the verses. So all the verses in that collection are his. They're quite beautiful. I think they're really the most beautiful poems in the koan tradition. And his teaching style, if you are familiar with his teachings in Cultivating the Empty Field, his teaching style was very, very poetic, rich with images, sort of allusions, really beautiful ways of expressing the Dharma. You know, I spoke recently about, well, there are teaching styles, you know, there are teaching styles which is giving instruction. We give instruction in Zazen, we give instruction in various forms of practice. There are teaching styles that are communicating the teachings in a direct way, in a fairly linear way, kind of a didactic way, conveying information. And then there are teaching styles that are more direct, which means that the language has to be different, right? Because it can't be explaining, because that's not very direct. When we explain something, where we have to sort of organize it and, in a sense, solidify it, put it into a coherent, cogent, you know, sense of information. And to really teach more directly, that can't be. And so think about the teaching styles within the Zen tradition, the use of poetry, the koans, these different ways, and not just in the Zen tradition. Read the songs of Milarepa, many of the teachings in other traditions that are expressing something in a live way, and often through images, metaphors, similes, so that the mind can recognize something in an ordinary sense and then make the connection, make the relationship between a seed, right, that is hidden underground, or, you know, a precious jewel that is covered in dirt. And we can recognize it as a way of talking about our Buddha nature. And so Hongzhu was just wonderful with this. And so I wanted to, with this talking on Saturday, speak to this poem, which means I'll have to do it sort of, I mean, we could spend a lot of time just on one stanza. Hongzhu was also known for teaching silent illumination, this style of Zazen, which is not unique to the Zen tradition. You see it, or in various forms, see it appearing in other Buddhist traditions. When Dogen studied with Chuching, he brought back, he learned this form of meditation, and he brought it back and spoke of it as shikantaza, just sitting. Hongzhu said, "Stay with this, just as this. Stay with that, just as that." So shikantaza is sort of characterized as an objectless form of meditation. There are many forms of meditation that use an object, the breath, sometimes a visual object that's placed in front of the meditator, sometimes a visual object that is visualized in the mind. The koan, in certain ways, could be thought of as an object-focused practice, depending on how a person practices that koan. But even if there is an object that one focuses on in meditation, to ultimately, or to see into the ultimate nature of that object, it has to become objectless. It has to become formless. It has to stop being an object. And so, in the earlier stages of practice, when a student's working with the breath, counting the breath, following the breath, becoming the breath, that is working towards dissolving that sense of separation, that sense of I am practicing the breath as an object of my attention, and that in becoming the breath begins to become vast and permeating. And if we think of shikantaza, you know, if we reflect on Buddha nature, that we all possess Buddha nature, so from the very beginning, that which we seek, the fundamental source of our liberation, which is to realize that all aspects of the self and all things are already liberated, are not bound, and that can only be realized in what we call the present moment. Right? No one ever came to realization yesterday or tomorrow or apart from this present moment. Suchness, thusness, is the essence of that realization, which is that present moment which consumes the whole universe, in which all sense of self has dropped away, in which there is no more discriminating consciousness. Liberated. There is nothing to be in conflict with. There is nothing that possesses the quality of conflict or the things necessary for conflict to be present, which is something to attach to, something to reject. And so if you think of shikantaza as sitting, just sitting, really sitting in that totality, thus, there's nothing to be done. Buddha nature is present and complete. The totality of this moment is always the totality of this moment. There is nothing that needs to be put in front of oneself. There's nothing that needs to be taken away. It need only be seen directly. Other forms of meditation bring the student to the same awareness, the same realization, but in a different, slightly different way. Dogen says, the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? The true vehicle is self-sufficient. What need is there for special effort? Indeed, the whole body is free from dust. So why believe in a means to brush it clean? It is never apart from this very place. So what is the use of traveling around? So he's really saying, making that very clear. And at the same time, it can't be passive, right? Because in a sense, if we don't do anything in the old way, in our old way of understanding that, we'll be doing a lot, right? We'll be distracted, we'll be daydreaming, we'll be, you know, doing whatever our habitual consciousness does when we're not applying any kind of effort. And so there is a particular kind of effort, objectless, in shikantaza, in any form of practice. And that effort itself can become part of what we struggle with. Because it's, you know, most of our experiences with effort are bound up in a lot of tension, a lot of striving, a lot of separation, a lot of fear and anxiety, a lot of expectations. So when we bring effort into practice, to the breath, to the koan, shikantaza, that usually comes with us. And so it's working towards, because we can't be passive, but it's working towards a very refined kind of effort, to call it that, in which the effortfulness in all of those ordinary ways drops away. Silent and serene, forgetting words, bright clarity appears before you. Zazen is very simply bringing forth our natural mind into our awareness, because it's always present. But a nature is always present. The basic nature of our awareness, as bright and clear, is always present. But it's our discriminating consciousness, our attachments, it's our false views, it's everything that we put on it or project that dims and obscures. Silent and serene. And so serenity has that sense of calm, of peaceful, untroubled, tranquil. It's nice, right? But we can't make ourselves serene, right? We can't force ourselves. When we contrive serenity, it's not serenity. We have to come to it naturally. And so we employ the forgetting of words, the letting go of words. Words themselves are, in a sense, innocent. They're just words. They're sounds like word, right? That has a particular meaning that we use, the Buddha might have said, as a convenient designation. It helps us to communicate, to do incredible things. The words themselves are not the problem. It's the meaning in our relationship, our attachments, our confusion, our projections in the meaning. And so we practice moment after moment, bright clarity, discovering that again, bringing that forth by forgetting words, which really means to calm all of the reactivity in words. You know, it's hard to even imagine. I mean, I remember sitting before I even came here years ago, in my mind, I could see that my mind was getting quieter, but there was still a kind of secondary background, you know, blah, 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 that was not meaningful. It wasn't anything that I felt like I needed to put a lot of attention into, because it was just sort of very superficial, but it was still there. And I remember exactly where I was sitting. I was upstate working on a dairy farm, and I was sitting one morning before I went in. And I remember thinking, I guess that's just always going to be there. I couldn't imagine that it would ever not be there, right? Because I hadn't experienced that. But that too drops away. And so it's not even that the words themselves are the problem. It's that when they arise and our consciousness rushes in with everything we think about thinking, we become unserene, right? We are not calm and peaceful. We're agitated. We get riled up. We get distracted. We wander. We search. We cling. And so in forgetting words, dropping away words, discovering a different way of experiencing, a different way of being that is not through the constant sort of interface or intermediary of words and language and descriptions and naming. And in that way, we're moving much closer to just experiencing things as they are. Experience this as this. See that as that. When you reflect it, Holmsger says, it becomes vast. So there's the image of the mirror of samadhi, that the mind in its natural state is like a mirror. Whatever comes before it, it's just perfectly reflected. The mirror has no agenda. It doesn't want to see one thing or another. It doesn't get happy when, you know, one thing comes before. It doesn't get sad when another thing comes before. It doesn't reject. It doesn't, you know, reach out and grab onto. It just reflects. When you reflect it, you become vast. When the mind is allowed to experience things in this natural way, the experience itself becomes larger. Well, what does that mean? How can something be experienced as larger? Well, maybe an easier way to understand it is we know the experience of constriction, where everything is held back, pulled in, very tightly bound. That's not just happening, right? That's happening as a result of things that we are doing, have done, deeply held, deeply set patterns. And so when that releases, that sort of effortful contraction, then what naturally happens is what is naturally true. Vast. Where you embody it, you are spiritually uplifted. And that's one of the great challenges of practice, is to embody it. Not just in a moment, not just sitting there on the cushion. Although every moment that we experience it is transforming, because it's shifting the balance from that constriction to something that's much more open, to holding on, to letting go, to not trusting, to trusting, from impatience to patience. That's why it's so important in practice. Session gives us a perfect opportunity. When we experience those contractions, even in all their ordinary forms, tiredness, you know, achiness, irritability, that we stay with it, because when we pull, because that's a contracted state, when we pull away from it or try and push against it, that's more contraction. And it's reaffirming that that's the problem. Whereas when we actually practice it without denying and without clinging, it may still be there, but somehow it's not the same. It's as though something is becoming larger. We can hold in the contraction. It's very hard to hold anything. But as it gets larger, we realize our capacity to hold a great deal in a way that is more serene. Spiritually solitary and shining, inner illumination restores wonder. To be truly alone, the Buddha said, between heaven and earth, I alone am the honored one. To be alone in the totality of one's being, where there is no other, there is no thing. The mind is not creating any boundary or division or separation. Nothing can be found. There is the solitude of being in this hall, right? Knee to knee with each other, front to back, and to be in solitude. In the sense that our mind is not going out, it's not projecting, it's not getting involved in anybody else's business, it's not imagining, it's just here. Trusting oneself, trusting everybody else. To be solitude, solitary. Alone, but not isolated. Alone, but not cut off. It's like being within the Zendo forest of trees, right? And forgetting the trees, forgetting the forest, not because we don't care, not because they don't matter, not because, but simply because in that moment, it's not needed. I'm okay, you're okay. And if I'm not okay, I cannot be okay. Can you allow that? If you're not okay, can I allow you to not be okay? And if it goes beyond being okay, we have monitors, we have teachers who help guide. And in that forgetting, in that solitude, we actually discover the basis of how we can be here in this forest, amongst these trees, without conflict. And inner illumination restores wonder. You know, in samsara, everything becomes dim and obscured. So we might think that in every generation, in every society, where the samsara is increasing, how would we know? Because the lights and the sound gets louder and brighter. I mean, I don't know if you could actually verify that by measuring, right? But in our time, samsara is pretty strong. The noise and the lights are pretty strong too, right? Is that to try and cut through the sense of dimness, the sense of obscurity, the sense of contraction, the sense of a kind of dark spiritual darkness? For what purpose? Is it just so we can be entertained? Is it so we can forget our miseries? Or is it actually those, perhaps, but also is it in some way to actually feel in some way that we are actually alive? And if it's loud enough, if it's bright enough, if it's, you know, adventurous enough, then we feel that moment of aliveness. But it's not really ours. So it passes. Restoring wonder is kind of like, you know, being a child, where everything is like, oh my God. But it's not a child. We're not children. So it's held in a different way, right? Dew in the moonlight, a river of stars, snow-covered pines, clouds enveloping the peaks. All of these ordinary, everyday experiences. The morning sun on the grass, the bird song at dawn. But now that obscurity, that dimness is beginning to fade, and we can actually, something is coming through. We can begin to see, to hear, to taste, to feel, to know, to think from that place of wonder in a way that is alive and large. Ordinary things come calling in, and they can seem to have a special kind of power. But of course, if we just reflect, it's not that those things at those moments have assumed a special power just for us. Those things are just being those things. A dew in the moonlight, a river of stars. The crane dreams in the wintry mist, Songzhi goes on. The autumn waters flow far in the distance. Endless kalpas are totally empty. All things are completely the same. When wonder exists in serenity, all achievement is forgotten in illumination. What is this wonder? Alertly seen through confusion is the way of silent illumination and the origin of subtle radiance. And silent illumination carries the sense of the calming aspect of Zazen, mindfulness, developing into concentration, developing into samadhi, and illumination, insight, direct seeing. So seeing, when it's used in this sense in the Dharma, is not necessarily visual, it's experiencing. It's directly experiencing. The crane dreams in the wintry mists, the autumn waters flow in the distance. The heat of our strong emotions, of our attachments, begin to cool. right? Buddhism, passion, and the Buddha talked about dispassionate. He wasn't talking about being dead, you know, like we think of, you know, being passionate about something, caring about something, being wholehearted. It's being tangled up in strong emotions. And so as that begins to calm and cool, these images of winter, of autumn waters, right? All of that sort of abundance and richness and, you know, busyness, you could think, is beginning to calm and flow far into the distance. The tributary streams flow through the darkness, we chant in the identity. It reaches out everywhere. And that's really what our practice is presenting us with, as an invitation, we might say an imperative, right? That as important as what we do on this meditation cushion is, it has to flow forth far into the distance. And we make that very real, right? We do kintin. And we don't just say, okay, go take a walk and come back in a few minutes, then we'll resume our meditation. We continue our meditation while walking. And we don't say, okay, let's take a break and have a meal. We continue our meditation into the meal, into the working, letting it flow freely. Endless kalpas are totally empty. All things are completely the same. So one of the things that's naturally being relinquished when we sit, if you will, is time, right? And session, again, is such a perfect way to practice this, because if you sit here, like as people doing their first session often do, and you look at the schedule and you start counting up the hours, right? Counting up the days, adding it all up, it's impossible, right? But we're not doing session, right? We're just creating this mountain of impossible in our mind. Or if we're sitting here and thinking, how many more periods in the day, or how much time in this period, or. And so to relinquish time. You know, I mentioned that sometimes when I would be in a lot of pain and I would find myself sitting and just waiting for the period to end, I would think, I'm wasting this time. I'm not actually doing Zazen anymore. And so I would imagine that rather than there being, well, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, yeah, I can make it. I would think there's 30 minutes left in the period. Way too long to just sit there and grit my teeth. And that helped me. It was a contrivance. I was making this up. I didn't know how much time there was left. But I was making it up as a way to help me forget time. I can't rely on that to try and help me in this moment, because it's not helping me. So that moment can become vast, like a kalpa, like an eon. And in that, everything becomes the same. All dharmas have one taste. There's a teaching that the dharma and food both have the same flavor, and it's one flavor. But if all things have one flavor, why do we respond so differently to different things? Different thoughts, different emotions, different situations, different people. Why do we experience different parts of the day differently? You know, it's one of the ways in which our tendency to reify, to objectify, solidify. You know, that we can wake up in the morning and feel tired and grumpy, and solidify that in our mind and think, okay, the whole day is going to be like that. And then it's not. Or we can just go through a period where something is difficult, think, okay, or we're tired and we're thinking, okay, I'm tired today. It's only Wednesday, you know, so tomorrow I'm going to be more tired. Friday I'm going to be even more tired. But that's usually almost never what happens. So we solidify it in our mind and begin sort of preparing ourselves and actually starting to sort of respond to that imagination, that fantasy, as though it's true. And the power of our mind is that our body will respond. Our emotions will respond. We will start to get more tired. Not because we are or need to, but because our mind has that power. And one of the things that's really, you know, I think good to appreciate and remember from time to time is, you know, the self, the sense of self that we are trying to free ourselves of. So our minds perceive ourself. We have self-awareness. So we can be sitting here, I'm offering these words, you can be listening and be aware that you're listening, right? That's a very common, ordinary experience. So that's not the problem, because that's just part of what our mind does. But we project into that because it happens so frequently. And every time it happens, it seems like the same person that you are aware of is there. It's you, right? It's not like every time we become self-aware, it's somebody else. I don't become self-aware of Hojin. I become self-aware of me. And so that sense of, oh, it's me, oh, it's me, oh, it's me, oh, it's me, it's still me. It's me again. Day after day, month after month, year after year, it becomes like an inarguable assumption that there has to be a me because there I am again. And so that sense of self that arises and is strengthened through all of our experiences with the world, I look out and I see you. I hold this stick, this kutz. That doesn't look like me. It's not the same as me. Everywhere I look, I see things that aren't me. And so that sense of distinction, I am this, I am not that, is sort of a natural, inevitable result of just being in this human body. Even if, you know, we live in a culture or a sort of an ethos that teaches that we are connected, that we are interdependent, that, you know, to try and sort of bring home that in some way, you know, we're not just absolutely different. Still, our senses are communicating this. And so what we're trying to do, what we can perfectly do in practice by liberating ourselves from the binding aspect, the constricting aspect, the not true aspect of that sense of self, which is just a projection of our mind, is kind of asking a lot, right? It's not nothing, given that through our whole lives we've been having all of this sort of ceaseless experiences of difference, of separateness. And so just to appreciate that, you know, it's not for nothing that this is difficult. And yet at the same time, what we're trying to do, what we're practicing doing, in a way is the most natural thing that can be, because it's our nature. And it's the nature of everything. And so it's not hard because we're trying to go against something. We're not trying to deny something. We're trying to see what we have been denying all along. When wonder exists in serenity, all achievement is forgotten in illumination. Serenity is like a tranquil pond. When nothing is stirring its surface, you can't make the pond tranquil. Like, right, if you come up and the wind is blowing and it's all ripply, and you try and, you know, calm it down, that ain't going to work. You already know that's not going to work, so you don't do it, right? But we don't know that about our mind. When what is stirring it ceases, then the pond naturally returns to that state of serenity. And even as it's stirring and there's sand and silt that obscures our ability to see the translucence, the transparency, the exquisiteness of that water and see all the way through, the water, the sand, the silt, none of those things are a problem of themselves. They're not creating conflict with each other. They're just responding to conditions, just like our mind does. And practice is gaining understanding about those conditions and the causation that leads to them. so that we can see what are the things that really stir me. When that mind is calming, how do I see myself stirring it up again? What is this wonder, Hongzhi asks, alertly seen through confusion? This is the way of silent illumination and the origin of subtle radiance. This is how we discover the origin. And alertness is a very particular term in Buddhism. The Buddha said, what is alertness? In an early sutta, he said, there's a case where feelings are known to the student as they arise. They are known to you as they arise, as they become established, and then as they subside. Thoughts are known to you as they arise, as they persist, and as they subside. Perceptions, and so on. So alertness is seeing something arise, being alert, aware that something has arisen, seeing it as it persists, it has its little lifetime, and then you see it as it drops away. That's alertness. So it's a very clear awareness. He says, when going forward and returning, make yourself alert. When looking toward or looking away, when bending and extending your limbs, when eating, drinking, chewing, savoring, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, remaining silent, one makes oneself alert. This is how a student of the way is alert. So he's basically saying there is no moment that's outside of this in which we cannot bring that quality of alertness. And then we are alive in that moment. And the moment is alive to us. Wonder exists in serenity. Achievement is forgotten. And so the practice of this is to be able to just bring that alertness to that moment without trying to achieve something, trying to make something happen. I'm going to be very alert and I'm going to get that wonder, right? It's just alert, which we might say is just a certain level of trust. Trusting the Dharma, trusting yourself, trusting the way things are. And sometimes we have to come to that trust by not trusting and trying to achieve that thing, make it happen, make it happen, make it happen, and then realizing finally, because we can be stubborn, it's not happening. Okay, what if I give that up? Let's just give that a try. Upright and inclined to each other, light and dark are independent. Maybe I'll get into more of that as we continue on Saturday. Because what's running all the way through this poem is what we call dualities. Light and dark, heaven and earth, good and bad, liberation and contraction, enlightenment and delusion, and setting them against each other. That's why when we set ourselves against our mind, because our minds are busy and we want to be focusing on our breath, because strong emotions are coming up and I don't know what to do with them, because I'm having an experience that seems wrong, because I've been practicing a long time and this is still happening. The Buddha said, one should not despise what one has received, nor envy the gains of others. Envy what you haven't received. The one who despises and envies will not attain meditative concentration. We will not settle down. If we keep disliking, despising, rejecting, not wanting what we're experiencing, and what we can remember at that time, at that moment, is the one true thing that's appearing before you. Your opinion about it is your opinion. My opinion about it is my opinion. It's a thought, it's an idea, it's a desire, it's a belief. And when I impose that on the thing, there's going to be a struggle. I'm going to experience the pain of that conflict. If I can let go of the despising, the envy, the wanting, the not wanting, and actually experience what is appearing before me and trust the Dharma. Because the Buddha said, that is appearing because this is the moment. Its causes have ripened, so in this moment it appears before you. That means it's auspicious, it's propitious. This is the moment when we have the capacity and are being given by ourselves that opportunity for this to shift. If we practice it as best we can. When we don't seize it that way, then we tend to revert back to what we know and we basically strengthen that. So if we can remember in those moments, you know, I mean, let our not liking, let our opinion be like a signal. The opinion calls out to you and says, it's not about me, the opinion. Don't look at me. Don't worry about me. Look at that. So let the opinion be like a flare that is pointing back. And in that vein, if we put to good use what we experience, no matter how ordinary and mundane and, you know, it might seem, like just being tired or having an achy body, anything that seems to impinge on us, assert itself, bring forth an emotion, bring forth an opinion, and realize that as dukkha. Oh, this is the First Noble Truth. This is what the Buddha was talking about. All conditioned things are dukkha because we hunger for something else. And if we can see it, not as something, you know, in the way or troublesome, but as something noble, like a teaching. Like, oh, this is a moment, right? Then that can help us to practice it within that faith. So, shall we do that? Consider the alternative. You already know the alternative. There is another path. All the time. Always.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.